If I read a book and it makes my whole body so cold, no fire can ever warm me, I know that is poetry. If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry. These are the only ways I know it. Is there any other way? Emily Dickinson. Poems are just arrangements of sounds. They're marks on a page. But the right one can change the course of history, outlast whole civilizations, and turn a respectable man into a wandering vagabond. In today's episode, what poetry is, why we need it, and how a 13th century love affair changed the course of it forever. You're listening to I Heart This. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. 800 years ago in the faraway city of Konya, there lived a scholar named Jalaluddin. A respected expert on Islamic law, Jalal often delivered sermons in the city's gleaming mosques. Like his father before him, he was the revered head of an important religious school. Jalal's life was comfortable and interesting, surrounded by scholars and writers and filled with travel and big ideas. But that comfortable life was shattered by a chance encounter when Jalal was 37 years old. According to legend, Jalal was riding a donkey through a bustling bazaar, followed by an entourage of his disciples. Konya sat at a crossroads between east and west, and so this marketplace would have been full of different languages and the fragrance of exotic spices. Merchants would have been haggling, scholars would have been debating, people of all sorts would have been telling stories and exchanging the gossip of the day, when a wandering mendicant with piercing eyes and dressed all in black stepped out of the crowd, grabbed the reins of Jalal's donkey, and challenged him, "So, who's greater, Muhammad or Bastami?" This impudent ascetic was Shams of Tabriz, and Shams was everything that Jalal was not. Where Jalal was settled, Shams was a wanderer. Where Jalal was an influential and well-respected teacher, Shams was a nobody who had supported himself by weaving baskets. Where Jalal was a pillar of orthodoxy and convention, Shams was a bohemian in search of a mystical union with the divine. I imagine Jalal, somewhat miffed, trying to dismiss this bum and get on with his day. The Bastami that Shams had asked about was a legendary Persian mystic who had some kind of ecstatic union with the divine, a kind of Islamic enlightenment. And Muhammad, of course, was the highest prophet and founder of Islam. The answer must be Muhammad, hands down, right? Well, that's what Rumi thought, and he told the wandering monk so. But the monk pushed back. "But Muhammad only said of God, 'I cannot praise you enough.' While Bastami, in his ecstasy, would say, 'I am the glory. I am the glory.'" Now, to my ear, 8 centuries later and half a world away, this seems like some theological chest thumping, two guys in beards arguing philosophical niceties. But that was not what this was to Jalal. Have you ever had one of those conversations that takes an unexpected turn where someone says something that completely changes your perspective and you're left standing in a whole new reality, even though nothing else has changed? Because that's what happened to Jalal. He would later write that he felt a window open in the top of his head, and he fell, unconscious, from his saddle. And when he finally came to, he answered Shams from the dust where he lay, "Bastami took one swallow of knowledge and thought that was all, but for Muhammad, the majesty was continually unfolding." Read half a dozen versions of this legend and you'll find half a dozen different takes on what exactly Shams and Jalal actually said to each other. Whatever the conversation was about, something happened to Jalal that day, and also to Shams. The two instantly recognized each other as soulmates. They left the bazaar arm in arm, and Jalal left his comfortable and well-respected life, presumably because he had found something better, something greater. He and Shams entered seclusion over a series of meditative retreats. Of that day in the market, Jalal would say, "What I once thought of as God, I met today as a human being." It is never clear what the nature of the relationship between Shams and Jalal was. I can't tell who was the master and who was the disciple. Were they lovers or just incredibly intimate friends? I mean, either way, Jalal was intoxicated by Shams' company and vice versa. For a while, their worlds revolved around each other. But then, that too came to an end. One night, Shams got up to answer a knock on the door and never returned. Some say he was murdered by jealous students who wanted Jalal back as their teacher. Others say that Shams had taught Jalal all he could and simply left. Whatever happened, Jalal was heartbroken. He wandered desperately, refusing to believe that Shams was gone. In a poem addressed to his lost friend, he would write, "What was in that candle's light that opened and consumed me so quickly? Come back, my friend. The form of our love is not a created form. Nothing can help me but that beauty. There was a dawn, I remember, when my soul heard something from your soul. I drank water from your spring and felt the current take me." Months later, and nearly 400 miles away in Damascus, Jalal realized there was nowhere else to look. You might think it was the kind of realization that would have destroyed him, but it didn't. Something opened in his heart, like the day he was knocked off of his steed in the marketplace. In another poem, Jalal calls out to Shams, and you can hear Shams' voice in Jalal's mind answering him. He says, "Friend, our closeness is this. Anywhere you put your foot, feel me in the firmness under you." Shams wasn't gone. Shams was inside him. And from that day on, the poetry poured out of Jalal. Love songs where it is never clear who the lover is. God, wisdom, Shams, his own soul, the world itself. He writes, "In the early morning hour just before dawn, lover and beloved awake and take a drink of water. She asks, 'Do you love me or yourself more? Really, tell the absolute truth.' And he says, 'There is nothing left of me. I'm like a ruby held up to the sunrise. Is it a stone or a world made of redness?" Today, Jalal is known to the world as Rumi, the poet from the Kingdom of Rum, so called because it was carved out of lands that once belonged to the Roman Empire. And his work is venerated as the greatest in all of Persian literature. But not just Persian literature. Jalaluddin Rumi wrote of longing and discovery and pain and ecstasy in a way that ignited the hearts of people everywhere. As Jawid Mojaddedi, a scholar of Sufism, puts it, "His masterwork is arguably the second most influential text in the Islamic world after the Quran. Upon his death, he was mourned by Muslims and Christians and Jews. His work has been translated into dozens of languages, and today, translations of Rumi's poetry are among the best-selling works of poetry in the United States." But so what? Why am I telling you this? Why am I talking about poems from some 800-year-old philosophical religious bromance? Nobody needs poetry. As the Burundian human rights activist Etienne Ndayishimiye told Poetry magazine, "Most of my people don't engage in any way with the type of poetry published in this magazine because when it comes down to poetry and food, survivors choose food." You probably don't read poetry. I can say this with some confidence because almost no one does. If you are an average English speaker in the 21st century, the longest poem you read this year was on a greeting card, the number of books of poetry that you purchased is zero, and not any checked out from the library either. This is true even for people who say they like poetry. Liking poetry is cool and cultured and smart. Carrying around a copy of Dylan Thomas in Amherst might be just what you need to strike up a conversation with some cute co-ed, especially if you can quote a few lines. People like people who read poetry, and people like having read poetry, but actually reading poetry is a different story. And it's not hard to explain why. Poetry's hard. It can be boring. It can be confusing. Half the time, even if I think I do understand a poem, I ask myself, why did somebody put in all that effort and all those adjectives to describe a fish? A fish? I don't even like fish, I say. And then I go and turn on the television. At least that won't make me feel like the dumb kid who was too slow to pick up on some inside joke. So why bother? Here's why. Because I spend most of my life comfortably riding on a donkey through the marketplace. I'm asleep. I forget that I'm going to die. I forget that one day everything I love will disappear just like Shams did, without even so much as a satisfactory reason why. I need poetry because I am like the characters in Thornton Wilder's play Our Town, going about my errands and chores and gossip, destined to realize what I've missed only when I sit in the cemetery on the hill. At the end of that play, when the spirit of Emily, who has died in childbirth, looks out over the living, she asks the narrator of the play, "Does anyone ever realize life while they live it?" And the narrator answers, No. Saints and poets, maybe. They do some. Saints and poets, maybe. They do some. Poetry is here to solve a problem. The problem of sleeping through my own life. As Mary Oliver puts it, when it's over, I want to say, all my life, I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. Well, Mary, I don't either. I need somebody to grab the reins, to stop me in my tracks, and ask me the question that's going to open a window in my head and knock me to the ground. I need poetry because it does for me what Shams did for Rumi. Who knows why poetry does this well? I guess it has something to do with the same things that make it hard and confusing. Poetry is art stripped down to bare bones. No story, no context, no flashy colors or animated graphics. All you get are a few words. With poetry, there is so little to hold on to, you can't get your bearings. And so, you're disoriented, and Sham sneaks up on you and catches you off guard and shoves you outside yourself. That's part of it. The other part is even stranger. Somehow, the order of all these words and meat sounds that humans make magically matter. In her poem, Mary Oliver didn't ask, so, what are you going to do with your life? Because people have been asking you that since high school and looking at you over the top of their glasses, ready to judge whether or not your answer would measure up. No. She asked, what are you going to do with your one wild and precious life? And the first time you hear it, it makes you tear up, because when she asks it that way, you feel seen, you feel held, you look at your own self with a compassion you didn't know you needed, and you feel like somehow, as big as that question is, it's okay if you don't know the answer. Look, all we have in life is our attention. That's it. And as far as I can tell, all a poem does is focus it, bend it a little bit into itself, like light passing through the lenses of a microscope. It makes me look again at a grasshopper or an old raincoat or a dusty windowsill, and somehow breaks all of my explaining long enough for me to see how strange and magnificent it is to be alive, however briefly, in a world of such mysteries. Being grateful for poetry is really being grateful for the possibility of waking up. Even though I know I'll fall asleep again, the washing machine will break, and I'll get a crack in the windshield, and I'll be sucked right back into the whole anxious disaster. But in poems like Rumi's, I feel this electric start of recognition. I know that moment when you fall off your donkey and into a black hole. You pass over the event horizon and know there is no escape. That the world will never be the same again. I know what it's like to long for something I can never have, and I know what it's like to discover it inside myself. So here's one more by Rumi. The wilderness way Moses took was pure need and desolation. Remember how you cried when you were a child? Joseph's path to the throne room in Egypt, where he distributed grain to his brothers, led through the pit. His brothers left him in. Don't look for new ways to flee across the chessboard. Listen to hear the checkmate spoken directly to you. Mice nibble. That's what they need to be doing. What do you need? How will you impress the one who gave you life? If all you can do is crawl, start crawling. You have 100 cynical fantasies about God? Make them 99. If you can't pray a real prayer, pray hypocritically, full of doubt, dry-mouthed. God accepts counterfeit money as though it were real. So, full of doubt and dry-mouthed, I come back to poetry like scripture, almost every evening, peddling my counterfeit coins. Like Rumi wandering through Damascus, I'm looking for love and am lost myself. I search for that one twist of words that will strike my heart with lightning again. And when it does, for one brief flash, I see the world for what it is. In each episode of I Heart This, I set out to do something like what poetry does and make the familiar strange and wonderful. Truth is, maybe I could do this best just by pointing the way to Jane Kenyon or Naomi Shihab Nye or Sharon Olds or Ted Kooser or Walt Whitman and then just get out of the way. So here are two pieces of iHeart homework for you. First, head on over to the episode description for links to poems that have changed my life and, you know, just may change yours. And second, if you found something valuable here, pay it forward. Share an iHeart This episode with someone you think might need some hope or inspiration, or who might be grateful to look at the world with some renewed appreciation. I Heart This is a new episode every Wednesday. It's written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Brian Imaro Cribbs. Our theme song is used with permission from neosounds.com. Our website is iheartthispodcast.com. We're on Facebook at I Heart This Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.